What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back, or welcome to the High Flyers podcast. For the curious ones, where we share diverse experiences in life, not just work, tune in and learn to fly high in your own way, from value creators and problem solvers at all aspects of society. Learn about their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and so much more to help us all be 1% better every day together. And I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal.
I would have paid for the CD. Like, it was that much fun. And so through journalism, I got to meet different kinds of people in different professions, and I met entrepreneurs. And that was the moment when I interviewed entrepreneurs for the first time that I realized that my whole life, and I was 25 at this point, I had been building to this point to be this person. And it's just one of those turning points in life where you just, your life as it was and your life as it was going to be, just completely different things. And so that was the moment that I became an entrepreneur. Certainly there was a couple of years of really searching in between that.
That's Nick Crocker, and this is episode 48. Now, before we get to the episode, I'm excited to share an exciting venture called Curiosity Center, launching early next year as a step on to this podcast, bringing together the best content, the best guests, and the best community to you, the student, and all of us, live and on demand. Stay tuned for more details very, very soon. Now back to Nick. You know those conversations where we all have them? We have so many questions, but the discussion actually covers a lot of ground. That's how this conversation went. Nick shares his idyllic upbringing in Queensland, Australia, which for our global listeners that might not be as aware, Queensland is Australia's bush country, laid back, a big percentage of nature and bush. You hear about Nick's adventure living in France at 17 that opened up his eyes to the world, and then his foray into journalism and his passion for writing, which led to discovering entrepreneurship, and as Nick calls it, was love at first sight. We get into a number of specifics, including moving from Australia to the US, cultural adjustments, plus founding the company Sessions, which were later acquired by Under Armour, all whilst having a long-distance relationship with his now wife. I asked Nick about how he cold-messaged people early on, including his co-founder of Sessions, and also Nikki Shivak, the co-founder of Blackbird, one of Australia's prominent startup backers and VC funds. Now, we're not VCs investing money, but how do they make money? Who's Nick's favourite board member and why? Helping elite athletes in Australia get into investing, and Nick's observations with them. A common theme I observed through this conversation was Nick's importance on family and having that support unit. And stay tuned till the end for a special insight on meditation, a routine Nick places high importance on in his daily life. Hear about a specific meditation course Nick went on and how he was his best investment in life. Nick, welcome to the show. I've been wanting to have you on for a long time, so I'm glad you finally agreed to join me.
It was an easy thing to say yes to, and I'm humbled and honored that you would have me on.
I'm excited to unpack your journey. And I think the first question is, given the name of the show, is there a high fly in your life that you think of that perhaps hasn't got the recognition to date?
So he does get recognition, but I don't think people fully realize his power. And the person I'm talking about is Michael Bacco. He's the CEO of Startmate. And I first met him when he ran operations at Startmate, and he's become a close personal friend. But he is someone who has massively exceeded my expectations. I obviously thought he was amazing, but I had no idea of just how incredible he would make Startmate. And so I'm really grateful for my friendship with him. I'm really grateful. I learn a lot from him. He has incredible standards across lots of areas of his life. And I don't think people fully realize how special Startmate has become in terms of an organization yet. And so maybe people already think of him as a high flyer, but I don't think people realize the extent to just how special he is.
And he had to fill in some pretty big shoes, I believe. The person before him was quite good. So,
well, you are alluding to the fact that at one point I was the CEO of Startmate, and I can assure you that Batco far exceeded any impact that I had on the organization. He has been far superior, so I'm very, very grateful that he took over.
Great. Now let's zoom out, Nick, and then go back to your sunrise, as I call it, your early journey and your formation. And I know you've talked about your parents, and you grew up in Queensland. I think your mum was a GP and dad was making furniture, from what I understand. Tell us about that. Like, what are your memories of your childhood, particularly your environment and the influence of family?
Yeah, incredibly idyllic childhood, growing up on 12 acres of forest, of which 9 acres was uncleared in the Sunshine Coast. So grew up surrounded by beautiful bush. Mum and dad were just incredibly loving and creative, supportive, empowering, and I was really close to both of them. And I'm the eldest of three, so if you're the eldest, you get this grace period where it's just you getting all the love and attention. And I think there's something foundational that gets set when you get first parents can be quite over the top, first time parents, and so they tend to maybe overlove their kids, and then they realize like kids are pretty resilient. So I was definitely a beneficiary of the overlove from my parents. Against that beautiful kind of family setting, I did struggle at some level growing up, feeling never quite like I fit in. I was very, very ambitious and not lacking in confidence outwardly, and so I don't think I was rewarded for the ambition or the confidence early in life, and probably was penalized for it, and learned some lessons along the way there. But on the family side, idyllic, and then but really the unlocking for me came after I left school and traveled to France and lived there for a year, and traveled to Mexico and lived there, and then got into the world of first journalism and then startups, and that was when I really started to become myself.
And I think that's a good point that I was going to ask is you've lived in the US as well, and now you're back in Australia. On reflection, do you think that grounded upbringing in Queensland and the country gave you an understanding, and you've been able to kind of evolve yourself through the different experiences you've had because of that childhood?
Yeah, I would say it's hugely beneficial at this point in life to have grown up. And where I grew up, there wasn't poverty, but certainly there wasn't great wealth in the area that I grew up in. And so you get the full spectrum of life from a very early age. And we certainly weren't, we were rich in love, but we weren't wealthy. And so, you know, it was a very humble, not over the top upbringing. That has been just an awesome grounding, just to know the full spectrum of the world and people's backgrounds and where people start. And then in fact, you know, traveling to live in Europe when I was 17 for the year, and living in host families, and then living in Mexico, and then moving to the US. And I have had this really awesome broad exposure to people from all walks of life in all professions. And I think it has shaped how I perceive other people. And a big part of this job is perceiving other people and making guesses as to how they might evolve. And I couldn't do that to the level I do it today without all of those formative experiences.
And then tell me, how would your teachers describe the young Nick in high school? What were your passions? I know you're a big sports fanatic. What were your passions at that age?
Yeah, I was like school captain and into everything and friendly with everybody in every year, and knew all the teachers. And I was like in a small school, I was absolutely the model student. I think they would have, you know, I was that kid with all the positive report cards, and that was a big part of my identity growing up, being that guy. You realize as you look back that some of it is an act, and that you are playing up to the perception that you want people to have of you. But for the most part, I was a model student and an obvious choice of school captain, and loved that role and felt like I was destined for it. So Kind of cliched in that sense, but life has a way of helping you quickly unlearn any bad lessons from school that you might have picked up.
And what about influences outside your family? You know, did you have any posters on the wall or any people you looked up to as heroes?
God, that's a great question. Who did I love growing up? I've always loved the NBA, but I didn't have a... It wasn't until LeBron James came into the league in the early 2000s that I really found a basketball hero. It's probably not a fashionable hero, but for most of my childhood, my hero was Andrew Johns, who's the halfback of the Newcastle Knights, and I think unquestionably the best rugby league player of all time. Not everyone agrees with that opinion, but it's certainly mine. So I was born in Newcastle. I grew up sort of hearing distance from what was then known as Marathon Stadium. So some of my earliest memories are actually hearing Friday night football as I'm trying to fall asleep coming through my window. And then when I was very young, my mum would take me to the games and she would sit on the hill and study while she was still studying for her medical degree. And I would just sit through three rounds of rugby league games, just enthralled, wearing my Mark Sargent jersey, who's a player that very few people will remember that I do because I wore his jersey to every game. So despite having like parents that had no interest in rugby league, inexplicably to both of them, they do not know how this happened, I fell in love with rugby league and the Newcastle Knights. And then the timing of that was Andrew Johns joined that team. So it sounds like I'm not sure there would be a ton of people in finance or VC who would name check Andrew Johns as a personal hero, but that's the honest answer, is he was. And I actually saw him once in real life, and I was probably in my mid-30s, and I was still had that, like, my heart started racing, and I was like, should I go get his autograph? I guess what I can say is I am in awe of excellence in any field, and he displayed it in rugby league.
I like it. And then last one before we go to magic moments, when you think back to when you were 16, what was success to you at that age in life? Broadly, like what were you wanting to do at that age in life?
It was definitely outwardly defined. So for me, success at 16 was speaking French and Spanish and becoming a human rights lawyer. And as I think back on having that image of myself, it actually didn't really tie into the work or the nature of what it might actually mean to be a lawyer. It tied into how I thought my status would be perceived if I was a trilingual human rights lawyer. That lasted about 2 weeks into law, and I realized like you actually need to have legal skills to be a lawyer, and I didn't and don't have any. And so that myth was quickly dispelled, and that was actually quite humbling. Kind of being a high achieving school student and coming into university, and I didn't fail, but I came pretty close to failing law, and that was certainly a shock to my system. And then when I did the applications to go to do the do work at law firms, I remember sending 13 applications and getting 13 rejections and not a single interview, and just thinking, like, taking that pretty hard. Like, that was the sort of first outward failure, but it was actually a really strong signal and one I'm glad I paid attention to, which was just I was playing the wrong game.
I guess that's the moment you probably went from school captain to entrepreneur, right?
Not quite. So there's a step between that. I still didn't know what an entrepreneur was at that point. But I'd always loved writing. So if there was something that I was good at school, it was definitely English. And I was an obsessive reader when I was younger. There was this thing in Canberra called the MS Readathon, which was a thing where we lived in Canberra for a couple of years. You would read as many books as you can in a month and get sponsorship. And I remember the month that I did the MS Readathon, first of all, I read so much that I started getting problems with my eyes. And so mum took me to see an eye specialist because I was starting to get fuzzy vision. And then I won a tennis racket for like reading the most amount of books or something of any of the people that did that. So I think what happened is at some level very early on, millions and millions of sentences and different versions of sentences embedded themselves in my brain. And so I've always just loved sentences, compiling and editing sentences and then putting them, you know, expressing whatever I have inside my head on paper. So journalism was something I could do without any qualification except just being able to write. And so I loved music, and so music journalism was the first place that I went. And I started off reviewing, just doing CD reviews, and I wouldn't get paid. I would just get the CD for free, which to me was like the best deal in the world, getting free CDs. Just that I would have paid for the CD. Like it was that much fun. And so through journalism, I got to meet different kinds of people in different professions, and I met entrepreneurs. And that was the moment when I interviewed entrepreneurs for the first time that I realized that my whole life, and I was 25 at this point, I had been building to this point to be this person. And it's just one of those turning points in life where you just, your life as it was and your life as it was going to be, just completely different things. And so that was the moment that I became an entrepreneur. Certainly there was a couple of years of really searching in between that.
On the topic of writing, I'd encourage your listeners, if they haven't already, to check out Nick's articles online. I mean, I've been a big fan of that, and that's actually, I've got a whole bunch of questions here from some of the thoughts you've put down. And I think the cadence of your articles has changed over the years, but I think you were, I think, for a period posting them every week or every month with your thoughts on different topics, and they were fascinating.
Thanks for that. I was talking to, I have a executive coach, and he and I were talking about what role public writing plays in my life right now. And basically the drop off in my production happens when my first son is born. And since that point, there hasn't been a huge amount of output on the writing front. Right as he was being born, I did an exercise in writing 100 things in 100 days. Mm. So I had this big flurry, and then I've probably written 20 things since then. Where my writing is focused now is actually right internally when I'm writing investment memos. That's where I feel that creative energy and that creative spark. And occasionally I will get the time and the mind space and the inspiration to send out a newsletter, and I really enjoy that too.
Mm, I can't wait. And we'll get to your writing shortly. Now, before that, let's talk on magic moments. And this is probably the segment the listeners love the most, because I think it really unpacks the journey of the guest. And I think some of those moments that are kind of the asterisks in your journey in life and work, and particularly some of the painful learnings, Nick. I mean, you touched on before, you've had a number of them. And I call them painful learnings intentionally because they were probably painful in the moment, but a learning in hindsight. Is there one that you can think of that stands out in your life, whether it's work, family, travel, that was a painful moment?
Yeah, I mean, the almost defining moment of my adult life came right at the beginning when my dad died. I was just 19. And for anyone that's lost a parent, they'll know the incredible grief that comes with that. There's a specific kind of grief when an elder son loses his father, and suddenly you are the oldest male in the family. And I had younger siblings, and that felt like a heavy load to bear at 19 years old. And I bring it up because it's possible that had that not happened, I might not have appreciated how precious life is, how quickly it can be taken away, and how much of a gift every single day is. And so to the extent that my life has had a sense of urgency and impatience to it, I would say the source of that is actually the grief at losing my father when I did. And I don't think I'll ever lose that urgency or that impatience to get the most out of every day. And I certainly would not be the person I am today had I not been through that period of profound sadness, definitely at points, I think, depression, and just the huge, I remember, like, I don't know if I wrote it or described it this way, but it's this feeling of being on a ship and being kind of warm and tucked away inside the ship, and then suddenly just this wind blows the top off the ship and suddenly rain and wind is pouring in, and you no longer have that protection that, that you know, your father can bring. And so you have to kind of grow up pretty fast, and I did, and in the end I've made it be something that has had a net positive impact on who I am today. But it was certainly a defining moment in who I am and how I live.
Thanks for sharing that. Very, very candid. And if I can ask the opposite of that, is there a moment that was the most energizing or the most fun that stands out? Maybe it's one of your travels.
No, it's meeting Julia, my wife. And it was, I met her before, the couple of months before my dad died. And it was almost like she just came into my life with the kind of force of the sun. Like she just, from the second I saw her, was just blinded by this kind of incredible presence. And we're still together today, and we have two boys, and we basically became adults together. Like we now spent more than half our lives together. So I feel extraordinarily fortunate of the timing of meeting her. And when you're 18, you really have no, I look at what 18-year-olds look like today, and they're just so young and they know so little about what the future holds. So to find the love of your life at 18 and have that relationship maintain through your entire kind of adult development is like it's there's a component of luck to that I'm so incredibly grateful for. And the time that we've spent together is, those are my best memories. And you know, now having created a family together and all the challenges come with that is the most valuable, that's the most, you know, impactful thing I will ever do and we will ever do. And it's never like easy, but it's profoundly it feels purposeful and incredibly fulfilling.
And she was with you during your time in the US as well, right?
Yeah, funny story. She was studying medicine in Adelaide. So right. We made a very contrarian bet as 20, you know, people in our early 20s, where we stayed together. We actually got engaged, and I went to the US and she stayed in Adelaide to study medicine. And we, from 09 to 2013, for 4 years, we did long distance. And I am so glad that we had the foresight to make that decision, because by going our different ways professionally and geographically for 4 years, each of us was able to sort of self-express, for her being a doctor, for me being an entrepreneur, and then kind of come back together geographically once we'd made our way through each of those challenges. And she graduated medicine right when we sold Sessions, and that's when she moved to the US. And yeah, I look back on that and I'm like, that was a really brave decision that we made, and I'm so grateful that we did.
And I think that's probably a good point to talk about, as a US experience. And I've got two questions in that. I think first one is, you talked earlier about Queensland and your upbringing in a country secure environment, and here you are in the US building a company that you eventually sold to Under Armour. Tell me about that. Like, is there a moment that stands out there, particularly around the integration into the US culture? Because I've had a number of guests on the show who, and I'm using this in your own experience now, is a lot of Aussies go to the US and that humility needs to be put away for a little bit, right? And you've got to kind of beat your chest a bit. How did you find that integration in the US, particularly as a first-time founder and then selling your business? What was that period like?
Well, if I didn't feel at home growing up in Queensland, if I didn't feel like I could express myself, the second I got to the US, it felt like a great spiritual exhalation. And this great sense of relief washed over me, where I was like, I can be whoever I want to be. I can fully self-express in this country and no one will bat an eyelid. And I am in love with that part of American culture, that part that accepts and almost expects great ambition. So it was so, I felt so at home finally. Like I felt like I'd landed where I belonged when I got first to New York, and then I moved to San Francisco. And certainly New York, San Francisco was a good experience, but New York is like still my favorite place. And I still hope we get a chance at some point to live there as a family. I think it's the greatest city on earth. In the lockdown, I would just watch cycling videos of people cycling around New York just to like feel like I was back there. I had such a wonderful experience there. I love the US and I feel, look, Australia, and especially around entrepreneurship, has changed so much in the last 10 years to the point where we really celebrate success. I don't think there's certainly in the startup ecosystem no tall poppy syndrome. Like everyone's cheering for everyone to go higher, further, faster. So that's pretty awesome. But 10 years ago, it didn't feel that way to me. And the US certainly was what unlocked that that part of me.
Yeah, and I've got a question here to ask you about a Medium post you did about how you connected with Nikki. But before we get to that, I think what I'm curious about is, and this is off schedule, is would you have considered staying in the US after you finished your time with Sessions and Under Armour? Like, was there a motivation to want to come back to Australia?
Yeah, there was three options. One was start a company, two was start a fund in the US. So I was going to start a healthcare fund, or going to start a company with a friend, or come home. And ultimately what changed when we had our first child, he's six now, his name's Oscar. When we had Oscar, we just realized how desperately we wanted to be around family. And grandparents are so valuable. I don't know what your experience is, but I think one of the best parts of my upbringing was the ability to be close to my grandma and grandpa on my mom's parents. And this just the stability that they provided me and the kind of just love. And I just think there's some power to projecting yourself into the future. They were in their late 80s when they died. I think my grandpa might have been a bit older, and they were together for more than 60 years and died 2 weeks apart. You know, it's
incredible.
When that's such a foundational story for me for how to live a good life, and that's just proximity to my grandparents. So I wanted my kids and Oscar to have proximity to my mom and Jules's dad. And at that stage, my brother was here. So having family around, just the way you perceive the value of family changes so much when you have a baby. And so in the end, it was an easy decision to come home. And actually, we could have sustained that side of things for another year or two, but it was ultimately a decision for Julia to come home and pursue her medical career in Australia and not the US that tipped the decision to moving home. And so she was able to come back and specialize.
And then you reached out to Nikki, I believe, through Twitter, and you met for a coffee in Sydney back in 2015-16. I might be getting the years wrong. I think the question there I've got, and a lot of listeners I'm sure wondering this, is cold messaging and approaching someone is sort of common now, but maybe back a couple of years ago it maybe wasn't, and remote working and things. How has that evolved for you in terms of, do you still reach out to people cold message, one? And then two, if someone reaches out to you, what makes you respond to someone in a general sense, not an investment sense, but a general sense in terms of mentoring or them just wanting to get to know you as a person?
Yeah, good question. So Nikki and I met because I had the idea to do Y Combinator in Australia. I started pitching it to a few people and they said, oh, there's actually another guy doing that idea. His name's Nikki. I thought, I better go check out, see if this guy's, you know, why has he got my idea? And then I met him and he told me what he's doing. I was like, your idea is way better, that you're going to do this and I'm not going to. So instead of doing it, I just invested in Startmate. So that all started from a DM on Twitter. Ben Hartney, who I co-founded Sessions with, that started from a DM on Twitter. Cold reaching out to people cold, you know, for me, when I moved to New York, I got to do that because I'd sent a direct message to Zach Klein, who was someone I'd really admired, who had co-founded Vimeo and has since gone on to do a bunch of wonderful things. And so cold messages were the secret to my success. I am sad to say that I don't send them anymore. I would if I had time to put, if I had open slots in my calendar, I would love to do that. I occasionally do it. Just sometimes someone will capture my interest and I'll send them a message. The last investment I did came from a cold email that I sent someone who I was a fan of their work. So it still happens. It's a weird conundrum where I'm in a better place than I've ever been to send cold DMs that get a response. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I have no time to actually do that. So there's some tragic element to that. And in terms of people that reach out to me, I would say, like anyone in the position that I'm in, I get a huge amount of inbound. And all I will say is that quality really stands out. Most of them are not differentiated, and they're kind of generalized asks or very hard things to action or respond to. And I really do try to get back to everyone because I was in that position and I know how much it meant. But the best messages are still personalized and clearly meant from me and give me a sense of that individual and why I might want to connect with them. And there's still nice moments where people send notes, and I do really appreciate it. I just wish I had more time to open myself up to that serendipity.
Mm. Great. Now let's talk a bit about Blackbird and investments and entrepreneurship, but not the traditional questions. I think the first one is, how do you think you've evolved since you've joined Blackbird? I mean, at a personal level, like what's been your biggest sort of development, if you can share it a candid way, as an individual?
Yeah, I mean, it's meditation.
Okay.
I learned how to meditate, and then I started practicing meditation. I aspire to do it daily, and I end up doing it 3 or 4 times a week. The days that I meditate are better than the days that I don't. It's like the foundational behavior for a good day for me. I am someone who I've come to learn I have a very active mind, and I think I have a mind that tends to melancholy. And so kind of left unchecked, my thoughts can just kind of spiral, and sometimes almost out of my control, they spiral negatively. And meditation allows me to catch that and observe that. And, you know, one of the meditations that I did recently, this sort of provocation was, what if everything in this moment was just as it was meant to be? So like, not that everything's perfect, but just that whatever is going on for you in that moment, it's okay just for it to be the way it is. And it's having that acceptance. And so I would say meditating has led me to be more mindful, and being more mindful has enabled me to be a better operator in my day-to-day life, with especially as I find myself in stressful situations versus being reactive or fear-driven, or I'm much better at observing what my thoughts are doing and having some control over how I choose to interact with them versus being guided by them or sort of owned by them. So was my executive coach, Ben Hudson, who got me into meditation. So this sort of combination of mindfulness and executive coaching has made me so much more sustainable in the way that I'm able to work, and just much more authentic and comfortable in myself.
This question actually fits in well with the answer you just gave, so let's see how you answer it. Do you ever think about the weight of your words, particularly with founders and other board members? Because I think you touched on earlier the influence that you've got. Do you worry sometimes that people might change their actions based on what you say, and you might mean it as just a sentence or a phrase, but you don't expect them to ponder on it the next day or the next week?
Yeah. One of the founders that I work for, she said to me once, you turn up to these conversations as you, Nick, but you don't realize that you're also my investor and my board member. And so you think you're just being you, but you're actually showing up in multiple different ways. And so be conscious of that. And actually, this is something every CEO has to learn to deal with, is when you walk into the room, you might be you, but you're also the CEO, and that comes with extra weight. I would say that is not something I am very good at. I actually have to work on the opposite, which is to be very, very mindful of the weight my words carry. And one of the things that comes with being someone who likes writing and sentences is that sometimes you can speak in very definitive, clarity, like definitive and declarative ways, because for whatever reason, that sentence just has come together in your head, but you might not feel as strongly as that. And I've had to really work on trying to monitor my language in certain situations, because it can tend to be too harsh or too full on. And I still would not say I'm very good at it.
And with founders particularly, I mean, given that Blackbird does often invest in the idea, right? And you would learn about the person as you get to know them. I wonder if there's an experience, and you don't have to name the person or the company, where they evolved through the journey and you had to help them grow as a person. Like you invested in them very young or very early in their career, and they had to evolve. I wonder if you can share a couple of examples, because I think that's one thing I hear a lot, that founders are worried about with VCs. They go, oh, I need to be a complete person. What if I'm not ready to work with a Nick Crocker? Have you had experiences where someone's quite young in their career or life and you've had to help them, but they've got a great idea?
Yeah, I mean, that happens all the time. I think what I would say is my job is a job of service. And so the power dynamic is not that I, as the VC, exert influence over a founder. The power dynamic is I, as the VC, serve the founder and serve the company that they're building. And so I don't think in those terms of me shaping a founder. I think in the terms of getting to know a founder, getting to understand a founder, building up that data set over time, and then putting myself in a position to observe when that founder might be operating sort of outside of what I've observed of them. And so that can be quite powerful, is just making an observation like, hey, I've noticed this and this seems different to what I've understood in the past. How are you going? Sometimes that's described as like you hold up a mirror to someone. And so I try and be a good mirror to the founders that I serve and to understand who they want to be and help them reach that end. But I definitely don't think in the founder relationships that I'm in that there's a power dynamic where I am like it's either equal or I am the servant kind of thing. And I think if you take that service lens to this job, you very quickly do away with any concept of sort of playing God.
And if we talk about boards for a second, I'd imagine you work with many different board members in a direct capacity or indirect. Is there one that's your favorite or best board member you've worked with and why?
Wow, what a great question. I can't pick one because I'll offend everyone else.
Maybe don't name the person, but can you share the experience?
I'm not going to name the name, but we had a really difficult board meeting recently with one company. Really, really difficult decisions. Lots at stake. Lots of people with differing views, differing incentives. Like heavy people don't talk publicly about how hard some conversations are at the board level because you can't. You can never breach that trust. But it is an unspoken part of this business that you have to be a great operator and a great servant in very, very highly charged contexts. But I was deeply grateful to this board member because he's very experienced, much more experienced than I am. And he had observed, I had had to take this central position in the board meeting where I was, I don't know if you've ever seen that concept of being drawn and quartered where four horses pull you in a different direction until your body rips apart. Like that's a little bit what it felt like. I was barely keeping the horses in check. And he just called me straight after and he said, hey, how are you doing? How are you going? Is there anything you need? And it was just so, I was so grateful to him because in that I was doing my job in that moment. I didn't need anyone to ask me that, but it was so nice that he reached out and did that. So, he knows who he is and hopefully he hears this and knows how grateful I was for him doing that.
Fantastic. Now, as you probably discovered, this show is bigger than business. It's about life. And the business of VC, I think, is something that a lot of listeners might not be aware of because they come from different industries or different backgrounds. I wonder if you could provide some one or two specifics on how the business of VC works. Like how does a VC make money?
Yeah, great question. So how do I explain this in the simplest way? So there are these huge pools of money all around the world and people need to make more money than they have. So let's use superannuation fund as an example. So every week or month you put money into your superannuation fund and that superannuation fund promises to you that when you retire, they'll give you back way more money than you put in. And so what they need to do is they need to give that money to people who can help grow it. And they put it into everything from infrastructure to real estate to cash to foreign exchange, all kinds of things. But they also give it to a group of people, of which I am one, called VCs. And what VCs do is they take that money and they invest it into very early stage companies. And the hope is that you invest at the earliest stage and that capital grows very, very quickly because the businesses grow very, very quickly. And then the cycle sort of comes full circle when the company succeeds. We as owners make money in that transaction and then we're able to give it back to the super funds who then give it back to their members. So the core thing that we do is we make decisions about which companies to invest in. And the job that we have is to invest in companies that rapidly increase in value. What I do like about the alignment that we have with super funds, which is where the majority of our money comes from, is that super funds have an obligation to their members. And there is an obligation for us to improve the lives of their members. And that hopefully happens in terms of increasing their wealth, but also by creating these companies, you create amazing products and services that make the world better, and you create amazing jobs that thousands of people can go to and get better and then go on and do something that they might not have otherwise have done. So there is something beautiful and cyclical to the way we invest and the people on whose behalf we invest. And if we do our job and find successful startups, then we should be able to fund Australian startups into perpetuity, even just with a tiny fraction of all the superannuation capital that exists. And I think, you know, in terms of heroes and leaders, Paul Keating for me is one, and his decision to introduce superannuation to Australia back in the 80s is truly one of the great political decisions of our lifetimes.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned super, because I know for a fact a lot of people in general don't know where their super money goes, right? I know for maybe 10 years ago, I learned that super is invested in the share market. I thought it was just a savings account, right? I mean, that's something that people just, it's not taught. You don't learn that in school or university or life.
No, I know. Your superannuation is funding buildings and being built in the city. It's funding roads and ports. It's funding innovations, it's funding companies. And it is a pool of capital that's growing larger because it's being invested really well, and growing larger because all of us continually put our money into it. And so it's the nation building component of superannuation is, I think, grossly underappreciated. And I was the same as you. I didn't even know what super was when I was younger. I was just like, oh, what's this thing that's going out of my paycheck? But you realize what a powerful role in Australian society our super funds can play.
Now, let's talk about your systems and routines a bit. You touched on writing being one of them. One thing that I'm fascinated by about you is I think you consume a lot of different sources of information. Like if someone goes to your Twitter feed and just looks at the last 24 hours, you've retweeted a lot of posts that are VC, entrepreneurial, basketball, politics. Tell me about your kind of funnel of information. Like, do you have certain websites or resources you look at? Or do you just come across stuff? Because I personally find it challenging to consume so much information. You kind of create this list of stuff and you're like, I've got to come back to this. How do you like decipher what to read and what to consume?
Great question. So I actually don't, up until this weekend, I was following, I think, 50 people on Twitter. I specifically keep Twitter low volume on content because I don't want to have any reason to go back and check it regularly. I increased that to 365 followers of people I'm following just to expose myself to new sources of information as a change up in my kind of information diet over the weekend. So I'm midway through that experiment. I subscribe to about probably 250 newsletters. And when I have 15 minutes, I'll just go through, and I don't try and capture everything. I just try and capture the things that are interesting to me. I have like watch back playlists on YouTube that I save stuff to. I use Pocket to save articles to. And I'm actually okay with the fact that I save a lot of stuff that I'll never get to, because when I have a moment, I'll open it up and I'll see, well, what articles in Pocket should I be reading? And if they don't jump out at me now, then it doesn't matter that I miss them, because they're not piquing my curiosity or interest. And then I've subscribed to like thousands of YouTube channels. And so I find YouTube just the most fascinating rabbit hole, whether it's, I want to go down the rabbit hole of F1, or I've wanted to figure out who Logan Paul was recently, so I started to listening to clips off his podcast, or I went through a Michelin starred chef phase where I was just watching interviews with Michelin starred chefs and like watching the moment they find out. And then Marco Pierre White, I went through a Marco Pierre White phase, just watching old YouTube clips of him. I might get obsessed with a specific song and I'll just go find all the live versions of that song. It's just so fascinating to just go down the rabbit hole and go one layer deeper and one layer deeper. And then you go to the Wikipedia and then you're like, oh, they did a special release of that song at a New York concert that had, you know, this person guesting on it. And then you can go on. And I just love the internet. To me is such a magical place, because everything is there to be discovered and found. And I get a lot of energy from that discovery process. Like it's relaxing to me to just go down a rabbit hole of information. And at this point, like, I don't think I'm going to change my tastes and interests that much. So I just try and be really true. If my curiosity is spiked, even if it's to a place that seems weird, like watching a Dan Bilzerian interview on Logan Paul's podcast,
yeah,
that's not, I'm not moving the world forward with that. But it is important, I think, to understanding a component of our culture right now, to understand people like that and the role they play in it. And so I'm not going to fight myself too hard if I'm interested in finding out what that world is about. So I consume a lot. I feel pretty comfortable that I'm going to miss a lot, in fact, miss almost everything, and just try and be really guided by my curiosity and not too kind of embarrassed by it, because there's a reason for it.
Fantastic. Love it. So there's not a method that you have that we don't know of. So that's good. That makes me feel better.
All I would say is control it. Like, really control who you follow on Twitter. Really control, like, you have a choice about what you consume. We put so much responsibility on the Facebooks and Instagrams of the world, on them serving content to us. There's no discussion that we chose the content to be served to ourselves. And this is harsh as well, but you don't have to follow people on Instagram. Like, if there's someone on your Instagram that's annoying you or posting content, you can just unfollow them. Or if someone's retweeting too much weird stuff on Twitter, just unfollow them. Like, you have that choice to switch off. And I don't think people make that choice often enough.
Now, Nick, athletes, and specifically I've heard a couple of athletes in Australia. I know there's Delhi in basketball. There's a couple of AFL players who've mentioned you by name. You've helped them kind of transition into the investment space and kind of open their eyes up into a new world. What's been your experience in that, particularly around the mental shift? Because, I mean, I'm a huge sports fanatic, as you are. And when you're in sport, you have blinkers on and you're focused on sport and you just go in and you control the outcome. Whereas, as you mentioned earlier, when you're an investor, you're sort of servicing others. What's been your biggest mental shift with kind of advising or helping some of these athletes go into the investment world in Australia particularly?
Well, I'm glad you noticed, because that was a pretty cool moment for me when they called me out as someone that had helped them on their journey. So that makes two of us that realized that happened. I love my relationships with both, Matthew Dellavedova, who NBA player now plays for Melbourne United, and the other one is Matt DeBoer, who plays for the GWS Giants and runs Athletic Ventures now. And those two guys have become friends, and I've loved getting to know them and learning from them, specifically on athletes. I am so amazed and intrigued by the mindset of elite sport. Like, generally speaking, I'm amazed by just elite performance in any field. Elite performance in sport is there's so much that mere mortals like me can learn from how you get the best out of yourself as an elite athlete. And I think part of my amazement or interest in people like that is that I don't have the capacity to be that disciplined. I don't have the skill to actually play the sport to that level. So part of the fascination for me is that these people that have these skills that I just could never have. So that to me is hugely interesting. And I think also athletes are generally super confident, and I get a lot of energy from being with them, because you can't really scare an athlete with your ambition or drive, because they're just never going to be scared away. In fact, they're kind of going to be interested and lean into it. And I think in conversations I have with the elite athletes that I know, they're often kind of pumping me up or pushing me harder or questioning why I'm doing something. And I love that push and I love that challenge. And so the elite athlete mindset is something that I think there's a lot to be learned from and a lot to be gained from. And if I was able to help, I've been lucky to meet a lot of elite athletes over the last couple of years and to sort of explain how my world works. And that's been a great joy to see them have some success. I think if anyone hasn't heard of it, Athletic Ventures, which is a collective of elite athletes making investments into early stage technology startups, I think is differentiating itself as one of the best investment firms in the country. And that's a credit to Matt and the community he's pulled together.
And it's a trend that hopefully we'll see more of in Australia. I mean, you You said the US before. In the US, it's common. We see even kind of college athletes doing it, and maybe it's a sign of the capital available in the US was in Australia. If you're not a superstar athlete, you probably don't have the flexibility to invest your funds. So I think that's going to change over the coming years.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching a really, again, to talk about a YouTube rabbit hole. I was watching an interview with PJ Tucker, who's an NBA player, probably the NBA player with the best shoe collection of any NBA player.
Right.
And he was just talking about how fashion has played a role in his life. Like, he's a really gritty defensive player who doesn't score much. And yet he has this whole other persona that's kind of, he is the shoe guy in the NBA. And it's just such a fascinating example of where sport overlaps with culture, overlaps with fashion. And like, as we think about what is defining culture at the moment, it is coming. It's not just musicians and it's not just artists, but athletes now have they aren't just sports people now. They're culturally relevant and culturally defining people. And I think that's a fascinating evolution as well.
It reminds me of that documentary you've probably seen on ESPN, 30 for 30, about LeBron's decision when he left Cleveland and went to Miami, and how he bypassed the media landscape and did his own media through his company. I forget the name of the company now, but it's a multi-million dollar business now. And I think he's recently got a few investors on board. So yeah, I mean, disruption's ripe in that space. Now, if we move on to your hustle, and you've talked about your work, so I want to ask you what you do. I think what I will ask, and people will be curious, is what do you think separates a good VC today from the pack, particularly in a space where there's a lot of inflow and outflow and a lot of discussion and positivity? But if you just talk about Australia, what do you think today separates a good VC from the pack outside of just numbers?
Yeah, so look, you've got to address the numbers, because if you don't deliver the numbers, if you don't deliver the returns, you don't get invited back to do it again. I'm not talking about Blackbird here. I'm just talking about any fund that's investing on behalf of superannuation funds. You need to deliver a return to those funds and to those members of those funds. So you've got to deliver. But I guess you're saying that's table stakes. I would say the way I try and differentiate, and it's yet to be seen whether this is going to be long-term, durable and successful, but the magical moment to believe in someone is early, and it's before anyone else believes, and it's before they even understand themselves what they might be capable of. And investing at that point in time takes a lot of courage, because often the business won't be in an obviously investable state. It takes conviction, because anyone with half a mind for business can call out 100 reasons why that founder or that business won't succeed. When you're just starting out, there's a million reasons why you won't succeed and very few why you will. So you have to be the person that ignores all the reasons they won't and just focuses on the reasons they will. And so I think there's something very powerful to believing in someone very early. And so to do that, you just have to be constantly meeting people before they're really ready, before they're good, so to speak. So there's this great concept at Pixar where all Pixar movies are really bad for a really long time. Like, the first 2 years of any Pixar movie, the movie sucks. And that doesn't mean that at the end product, it's just having that comfort that as you're working through things and figuring stuff out and learning and trying, things are going to look pretty unsuccessful, and you're going to have to feel pretty unpopular for investing in things that everyone else thinks is a dumb idea. And so I think the courage to go early is the thing that I am trying to be. I think Blackbird really differentiates on. And then the specific part that I really focus on is just trying to have the highest quality relationships I can with founders. And it's not always easy, but that's the thing that I aspire to, is that quality of relationship, because that's ultimately what will persist through the decades as the company goes through all the twists and turns.
Now, time for the final sprint, Nick. So some rapid fire questions, and then hopefully you can give me 60-second answers. Is there one investment you've made that you consider the best in your life, non-financial?
The best non-financial investment I've ever made? Oh, okay, I got one. The best non-financial... the best non-financial investment I've ever made was doing an 8-week meditation course. So I am repeating myself here, but I'm going to give you the specific formula. The program is called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. So people refer to it as MBSR. And the program that I used is called Open Ground. So if you Google Open Ground MBSR, that's the non-financial investment that's unlocked the greatest leverage for me in my day-to-day life. And I didn't discover it until I was 35. And I wish I'd discovered it at 25. And I'm teaching my son to meditate and he's 5. So there is, if you don't meditate now or you meditate in an indifferent way, I'm telling you, do the MBSR course.
One thing you want to learn in the next 6 months?
What a great question. How funny that I don't have an immediate answer. Okay. One thing that I've observed in lockdown is that all I do is spend time with my family and work. And I need to learn to open myself up again to non-work, non-family stuff. And I know that sounds weird, but lockdown with the young family is intense. Anyone that's gone through it will know how much weight is carried in that word, intense. And so I need to teach myself to go and be a social being again after 2 years as a working hermit with two young kids that basically take up 100% of my time.
It's funny you say that because I get the sense you're very social. Maybe not drinking every night, but social as in you're aware and you've got a good friend, a good circle of friends and all that. So
I'm really grateful for this job where I get to spend 5 or 6 hours a day with amazing people and, you know, have conversations with people like you that I'm having right now. So that is where my social energy gets fulfilled.
True.
But if you were like, all right, 8 p.m., time to go out, I would be like, no, it's time for bed because I got to get up at 6:30 and do it all again tomorrow.
That's actually another appreciated part where your mental energy is already being socialized, right? So you don't need additional pub and bar visits. So
I just want to go on YouTube and watch stupid clips of old chefs making haddock.
Another one, is there one quote or person that inspires you today?
I think I have different quotes that sit with me through different periods of my life. The one I called it out before, the one I think about a lot right now is when I'm feeling a sense of discomfort or frustration or wanting whatever the moment I'm in to go away or to change, is to ask myself, what if everything I needed was in this moment right now? Could I just accept it for what it was? So I would say that has been a hugely repetitive thought for me over the last 3 or 4 months, is just, what if this moment had everything in it that I needed?
And last one, is there one thing you do every week to get the best out of yourself mentally and physically? I mean, you've already said meditation, so maybe that's the answer.
I do a lot of things. The most important thing that you can understand about good frameworks for living is that you don't rise to the level of your motivation, you fall to the level of the systems that you build. And there's a great book by James Clear, and you'll have to dig it up and put it in the show notes. I've forgotten the name, but James Clear, amazing newsletter that everyone, thank you.
3-2-1 newsletter, yeah.
So there's a great book by a guy called James Clear called Atomic Habits, and he talks about exactly that, that you have to set up systems in your life so that you will do certain behaviors regardless of whether you have any motivation to do them at all. And so all the best things in my life, whether it's tracking my time, planning the week ahead, reviewing the week that's just gone, meditating, finding time for exercise before the week starts, figuring out what I'm going to eat that week and when, all of that planning energy, that is all a system, and then my week will go, you know, basically as well as the system that I've put in place. And so this is coming full circle. Someone who nails this is Michael Batko, and he's written about it a lot. And so that's another newsletter recommendation, is Batko OS, I think it is, on Substack. It's a really great deep dive in how to get the best out of every week.
Love it. That's the finish line, Nick. This was super fun. Thanks for being so gracious with your answers. I know I've asked you a lot of pointed questions, but you've been fantastic. And I think you've had a fascinating journey that I definitely am inspired by. And I've been thankful that you've come on the show.
Thanks for inviting me. It's so generous that you say that.
I mean it. It's on record.
All right.
I hope you took away some actionable insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your lives and be 1% better every day. and I look forward to sharing the next episode with you next Tuesday. Stay tuned.